From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. In a moment, Project Camelot whistleblower testimony with Carrie Cassidy. And next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us. Incredible stories of high strangeness, including more on that strange boom that people are hearing all over the place. But here's what's happening. Well, at least 200 people now in 21 states and Washington, D.C. have been sickened by raw scraped tuna contaminated with not one, but two rare strains of salmonella. The tainted tuna has been linked to a couple strains of salmonella now, a frozen yellowfin tuna product known as Nakatochi Scrap, produced by Moon Marine, is likely the source of the outbreak. Earlier this month, the company recalled 58,000 pounds of the frozen tuna product, but more and more people are getting sick. The U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood has called for a federal law to ban talking on a cell phone or texting while driving any type of vehicle on any road in the United States. LaHood said it's important for police to have the opportunity to write tickets when people are foolishly thinking they can drive safely or use a cell phone and text and drive. Meanwhile, there is no evidence, they say, that mobile phones harm human health, says a majority safety review for the United Kingdom's Health Protection Agency. Scientists looked at hundreds of studies of mobile exposure and found no conclusive links to cancer risk, brain function, or infertility. However, they said monitoring should continue because little was known about the long-term effects. Look, I recommend you don't talk on a cell phone and stay away from it as much as you can. You know, go to a speaker, use your text, not when you're driving. When American experts talk about cyber threats from other countries, they often cite elite hackers in China, Russia. Well, now some are warning, don't forget Iran. That's right. Over the past 3 years, the Iranian regime has invested heavily in building up its cyber muscle and has expressed an interesting desire to use it. Lauren Weinstein on the show. Again, Lauren, I'm going to have to put an office in here for you. How are you?
Fine. How are you doing,
George? Okay, so this situation with Iran, that they could hack us, how real is this?
You know, George, I think we're being sold something of a bill of goods on this one. And, you have to kind of dig into the politics and the money, you know, always follow the money, right, to understand why. There's no doubt that Iran has cyber intelligence, cyber war, if you want to use that word, capabilities. But my personal feeling is that this is being overblown, particularly right now, because it plays into the goals of the cyber industry, the cyber war industry in this country, that is pushing very hard for legislation like CISPA, which you're going to be hearing a lot about if you haven't already, CISPA, which just passed in the House of Representatives today, after being made much worse today than it was yesterday, which would strip away privacy rights, basic privacy rights that we have now on the internet, anytime there is anything that is purported to be a cyber type attack. And there is so much big money and so much control that's involved in the cyber war industry now, that it just seems very convenient to say, oh yeah, now Iran, that's it. Now we have to worry about Iran,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Let's get this legislation done, and we'll deal with Iran, we'll deal with this, and your privacy rights, well, you know, they go out the window. CISPA is a really, really big problem. It sort of makes SOPA and PIPA, remember those?
Yep, the ones that we were fortunate enough to get squashed.
Right, well, CISPA kind of makes them look like nothing in comparison, because CISPA actually undermines privacy laws that have been in existence for a long time. But there's a fair chance the Senate won't go along at the moment. President Obama is saying he might veto it. But, there's no denying that the Iranians, you know, they do have capabilities. But I think that raising the alarm right now and waving the flag right now is really more about politics and money more than anything else.
All right, Lauren, thank you so much. In Switzerland, a woman starved to death after embarking on a spiritual diet that required her to stop eating or drinking and live off sunlight alone. The woman, in her 50s, decided to follow the radical fast after an Austrian documentary about an Indian guru whom we reported on some time ago who claims that he has lived this way for 70 years. She didn't make it. Dr. Robin Falkup with us. Robin, kind of a foolish diet, isn't it?
It certainly is. And Prahlad Jani, the man in India who everyone refers to, they've never really verified if he's only living on sunshine. So I wonder what goes on in someone's head as they, you know, they dehydrate and starve to death to think that they're going to survive. There's too big a disconnect there.
Eat, no matter what. You've got to eat.
Yeah, if you want to eat sunshine, grow your own food, pick your plants and fruit from the garden and eat that. That'll be really close to eating sunshine.
Robin's website, healthfreedomrights.com. Thank you so much for that. Well, the astronomers are jumping for joy. They found a star in a system 127 light years away from Earth. That's a long, long way, that has 9 huge planets around it. And they're really excited about that. The space station crew, 3 astronauts, set to leave the International Space Station within hours. They've been up there for half a year. Can you imagine that? Project Camelot, whistleblowers. Up next, Carrie Cassidy joins us. We're going to talk about that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Carrie Cassidy has a BA in English and a graduate work in sociology and MBA certificate from the UCLA Anderson Graduate School of Management. And she was working with Hollywood producers and major studios, independent production companies for years, has written a number of screenplays, acquired the movie rights to the Wingmaker story, incredible story there back in 2003, and then started working on her own projects and put together with Bill Ryan at the time Project Camelot, which is, well, let's bring Carrie in and let her explain what it is. Carrie, welcome back to Coast. How are you?
Hi there, George. How are you?
I'm doing great. Project Camelot, when you and Bill started it, it was around 2005, 6, something like that?
Yes, it was about 2006, April of 2006 to be exact. And so we've been in operation for a little over 6 years. And we originally met when I picked up a consumer-grade camcorder and decided to go out and sort of, rebel against the Hollywood system. I'd been trying to make movies and not getting anything off the ground, and I decided to go out and make my own UFO documentary. And so Bill was one of my first subjects. I was decided to go to conferences and put a camera in front of the face of the speakers and ask them if they'd seen a UFO and start interviews that way. And one of the people I interviewed was Bill Ryan. He was representing the Serpo project, and I know you're familiar right. with that. And so he ended up to be a very good subject, and we talked late into the night, and then he went back to England. He invited me to stop by on my way. I went to see Egypt, and on my way back, I stopped by, and he showed me Tintagel and the other power places in England, and we basically just hit it off, and we had sort of like minds about wanting the truth to get out there and disclosure. And we created the idea for Project Camelot in Tintagel, inspired by the King Arthur legend.
Well, and you know, you're determined. I've seen you at conferences. I'm going to see you at one on Saturday, the Alchemy conference in Los Angeles. You are a no-nonsense get right to it person, and what you've established with Project Camelot is a system where, unlike network television programs, where you know they do edit a lot, and a lot of times the person who's been interviewed says, "You know, I didn't say that," and you can take things out of context. You don't do things quite that way, do you?
That's right. Well, I do what, you know, I went to film school also, and so I sort of have an artistic bent that maybe a lot of people don't pick up, but it's true. And the reason it's what we call a guerrilla filmmaking style. And the whole idea is to allow people to tell their stories. I'm not your usual interviewer. I get a lot of flack for the way I interview. But people should know, anyone who's listening, that for those of you that don't know, it's actually a chosen style. There is method to my madness. I choose to provoke, in a certain sense, challenge. I'm very well aware that many of our witnesses could be mind controlled. When I see them going down a sort of a path where they're very, very comfortable in terms of their speech patterns, et cetera, I tend to interrupt them, throw them off off track so that I can get them thinking. And then I try to connect with them on actually a subliminal level. It's a whole different way of going about an interview. And I understand some people don't like it. Some people love it. And I have to say that it works to get the truth out. And that's really what it's all about.
You know, I would appreciate that. If you were interviewing me, let it roll. You know, that way, you know, there's no distortion. It is what it is. You know, I may say the wrong thing, but at least it's right there. What type of subjects do you go after, Carrie?
Well, Project Camelot goes across the board. What we're trying to do is paint what we call the big picture. So we are creating puzzle pieces. Each person has a piece of the puzzle, we say. And so if I were to interview you, George, I would simply zero in on a psychic level. I'm very, very intuitive on where you're coming from, where your strengths are, and where maybe your vulnerabilities are. And then I would sort of coax you to explore some things maybe that you don't normally do in conversation. For example, when I talked to Bob Dean, he cried on the film during an interview simply because he was so touched by his own experience and so, you know, connected with it during the interview that this man who had been interviewed countless number of times for many, many years and never broke down in tears, actually broke down in tears on my interview with him. And we became very, I guess you might say, lifelong friends since then. And I've interviewed him, I guess, I don't know, four or five times.
What have been some of, in your opinion, Carrie, the most important whistleblower projects for Project Camelot?
Well, first of all, I have to say Henry Deacon is one of the most important whistleblowers that we've ever had. And he was actually cross-disciplinary in Black projects, and that's rather unusual. Usually in Black projects, the people tend to zero in and stay in their own silo, what's called a silo of information, and they never go outside that area of knowledge. And so they aren't able to connect the dots. And the powers that be, the system, relies on that because they figure if scientists and engineers can't connect the dots, they will not realize the import of what they're doing and what it really means to humanity. And, you know, it's just like building the atom bomb. There are repercussions, you know, and sooner or later, as happens with the microbiologists that are dying now, we just had a recent another microbiologist who died, in fact, in England, someone who worked with David Kelly died in almost exactly the same way, very suspicious circumstances. And this is the kind of thing that that they don't want to see happen. They don't want these men connecting the dots and growing a conscience.
Do you find that the whistleblowers seem to be coming out of the woodwork now, or is it still difficult to find them?
Oh, God, it is very difficult. In fact, I actually think there's something of a shutdown right now, and I'm very sad to see this. When we first started, we were like everything we touched was magic. The entire adventure, we toured the entire world on a shoestring budget, but we had doors open to us. We had whistleblowers, you know, showing up in all kinds of amazing ways. And I can't say that it's closed completely, but I will say that the whistleblowers coming to the fore at this time are very few and far between.
This planet, Carrie, is going through an incredible metamorphosis where, you know, the divide between the haves and the have-nots continues to grow. People don't trust government, and in many cases, they're justified in that. Where do you think this is going, and where does Project Camelot lead with this?
Well, okay, that's a big question, George. First of all, I would say that there's a war for your hearts and minds. and that it's a war that the dark side is waging very, very seriously, and the light side as well. Certainly, I feel that Camelot's on the side of the light, and we are trying to awaken people to what is going on the planet, because the first step in becoming free is realizing how unfree you really truly are. This is a prison planet. We have been locked down for eons, actually, humanity, and I believe humanity is a composite of ET races. And so that means you, me, everyone on this planet has DNA from various ETs. And we are basically feet on the ground. We represent those ET races. Part of the reason we don't get along sometimes with other people is simply because we have a racial memory, if you will, of the wars that we have fought. So there's a huge spiritual war going on, and Camelot is really right on the cutting edge.
Is it difficult to get interviews with people? Do you have to just try to coax them to do it?
No, on the contrary, they approach us. In fact, we are very non-aggressive when it comes to getting an interview. And what's really interesting is that the whistleblowers that we've gotten almost without exception have come to us. So what we did originally when we created the idea for Camelot is we put up sort of the website. It was a very simple website, and we put a declaration on there basically saying that we would not commit suicide, and we asked for pledges, and we just had a huge, we're like a groundswell of people. We're a real grassroots organization. And since day one, something about Camelot seemed to hit what you might call the zeitgeist. And that hasn't changed. We're still doing that. So I don't know, we're kind of leading the charge, if you will.
And you're doing a lot of this out of your own pocket with some donations, Carrie. What drives you? Well, what keeps you pushing?
Well, I mean, I actually think we're here to save planet Earth and humanity. I mean, I don't take it lightly. This is where Bill and I had a complete meeting of the minds. We both agreed that the time we have incarnated this time around was a very crucial time for planet Earth, and that we needed to awaken as many people as possible, as quickly as possible. And Bill has gone his own way since a couple of years ago, and we don't work together as much as we used to. But I know he's still, you know, behind the mission in his heart. It's just that he's kind of gone off in a different direction. And so what I see about myself is that I have decided to stay on the cutting edge right up into the last moment. And that means that if Earth changes or certain dynamics happen on the planet where the dark side pulls certain things that they're working on very, very seriously at this time. If those things happen, then I will probably be the last to leave. And so that's just the way it is.
Carrie, because you step on some toes doing what you do, have you ever been threatened, or have you ever felt like your life was in danger?
Yes, we have been threatened. I've been threatened fairly directly. We've also been told to stay away from certain material or else. And we were told that not only would our lives become sort of very, uneasy, but the people that we were representing at the time, we were told their families would be in grave danger, et cetera, et cetera. We did move away from that material. That was one of the few times we sort of did, although I have to say that if you listen to me at conferences, I'm sort of the kind of person who doesn't like to be told what to do under any circumstances.
So, no kidding.
And yeah, I know you picked that up, George. And so basically I will sort of reveal, if you listen closely, I've actually revealed one who that person is that we're not supposed to talk about. I won't do that here on Coast to Coast. But yes, we've had tires fall off our cars.
Oh,
we were in this place called, I think it's called Grunewald or whatever, in Switzerland at the top of the Alps. And we just gotten to the top on a very windy road. We pulled into a small parking lot, and the wheel actually fell off the car. It was a clean break. We took it to a mechanic, and he said, there's no way. This is an old Volvo, and it's a very dependable car and all this kind of thing, and it had been checked out. But it was just a clean break. It just came right off. Had it come off while we were on our way up the mountain, I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't be here today. I have no idea.
All right. Well, you keep doing what you're doing, Carrie. And Carrie's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, open lines. Lots going on. I want to get your views when we come right back. Well, next hour, we will have investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe join us, and we'll have open lines for you for the rest of this half hour as well. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Gosh, lots to talk with you about this half hour before Linda Moulton Howe joins us next hour. FBI has a bulletin out to police departments across the country, by the way, as we approach the one-year anniversary of the shooting and killing of Osama bin Laden. They just said, be a little more diligent, be aware of things that could happen. I'm not sure you can do that. I think that creates more paranoia. You know, you're not going to stop this lone wolf out there doing whatever they're going to do. I mean, the smart thing is just to always be alert. And what happens, happens, sadly enough. There. Let's go to the phones. Blair in Sedona, Arizona. Welcome to the program, Blair. How have you been?
Well, thank you, George. I'm a little bit violated. I got frisked extra by the TSA this morning on my return flight from Bali in San Francisco.
No. What happened?
Well, after the, you know, you go through the hands up in the air electronic scan.
That's right.
Then you know, the TSA agents have the ability, if there's still something going, to pat you down. I was patted down by one TSA agent and then sent to another for, I guess it would be a hand check. What they got, they used a white circular piece of paper, and they pressed it onto my right palm, then passed it through a scanner.
Ugh.
So basically, I'm official because of my beard. I look more like Osama bin than George W.
Yes, you do. Oh, well, it's not a good situation. You know, there's one thing about safety, and I think safety can be, you know, done well without being compromised. There's another thing to be patting people down. They patted down a little girl yesterday, and I think they missed their flight because of that situation. Just not good. Were you irritated?
Yeah, basically, I turned around, and I said, I'm going to take some pictures of these guys. But they were blurry, and then I looked at the agents themselves, and they're just regular people, and they're doing a job,
Yeah.
And I thought, they're in the situation, too. And so I said, the heck with it, Blair, and I just stormed off and I talked to a couple of San Francisco cops because that's my hometown. I asked them about how the changes in Fisherman's Wharf were going. But, the thing about Bali, if anybody goes, it's about $111. That's 1 million rupiah for you math people. That gets you a day's tour, private guide there. So it's a paradise for Americans if you're on a budget. It's a nice place to be.
Well, I'm glad you're back, Blair, safe and sound. When I traveled from St. Louis to Los Angeles last week, coming back after my daughter's wedding, I took my watch off. And it's not a particularly expensive watch, but it's a big, thick watch. And I put it in the little bag I was carrying on. And I try not to check my suitcases. I like to carry on. So I had the suitcase, and I had this carry-on bag. And, I throw all my junk in that. And sure enough, it goes through the old detector. And the guy says, sir, is this your bag? Very polite. And I said, yep. And he says, we're going to have to go through it. I'm going to need you to stand over here and watch me. And I said, sure, no problem. And, he said, we noticed something about a watch, something strange. And I said, yeah, I've got a watch, and it's a big one, so it's right in there. And he took it out, and he said, gosh, I've never seen anything like this before. What is it? I told him what it was, and they put it through the scanner again. I got through. And then the watch got through. But that I don't mind. But the pat-downs, that's going a little too far that way. Terry in Toronto, Canada, welcome to the program. Hi, Terry. Terry, you there?
Yes, I am.
There you go.
Okay.
You got some feedback there. What's happening? Not going to happen. Try to call back. Mike in Boston, east of the Rockies. Hey, Mike.
Hey, George Norrie, nice to talk to you, man. It's an honor.
Well, likewise.
Anyways, I'm a mailman here in Boston. I'm a Coast Insider. I listen to you while I'm walking my routes. To comment on the TSA thing, as a matter of fact, I had I wanted to let you guys know the TSA is expanding, and they're at the train stations now here, at least here in Boston. They're here. I've seen them twice at two different train stations.
They are at train stations, and they're going to probably be at more places. It's going to grow as our rights are whittled away, Mike. You're going to see more and more of this junk happening all over the place.
Definitely. Well, the reason why I called was because I was asking, I wanted to know if you had heard an interview with, that David Wilcock had just done with this guy named Drake, some whistleblower named Drake. And basically he's talking about a plan of some mass arrest of the so-called Illuminati, or, you know, the higher-ups, if you want to call them. But apparently there's like an underground plan with people in government who are still good. And they've been working on it for like 30 years now, and it's about to roll out. And so David Wilcock just uncovered all this with this guy Drake, and he vetted him and everything and said it was legit. So
funny you bring that up, Mike, because we're in touch with David about setting him up for another show.
Oh, nice.
So it'll be coming up soon enough. I like David. David and I speak all over the country, and he's a regular guest here on Coast to Coast. He's not right about one thing yet, though. He said that a couple aliens would be flanked with President Obama. He said that about a year and a half ago, and that there would be a major disclosure announcement. And I said, David, I don't think it's going to come that way. And I happened to believe that government will not disclose. It's going to come from whistleblowers that people like Kerry Cassidy stumble across and present, but it's not going to come from the government at all. Let's go to Bob in San Diego. Welcome to the program. Hi, Bob.
How you doing, George? I've been listening to you guys for about 8 or 9 years now, and really interesting program.
Thank you. It's one of a kind, isn't it?
Yeah, one of a kind. You know, one question I have is you talk to these guys that talk about digging tunnels all under the United States, under the Denver airport,
yep.
Area 51 and all that. And my question is, why don't you ever see the tailings from all these? You know, you go to a mine, an open pit mine, or even a gopher hole. You know, you see a gopher hole going over, and they leave all these big piles of dirt. But if they're digging underneath the United States, where do they put all the stuff they get out of it?
And where do they go? Well, we know in Denver, for example, Bob, that the airport was created. And there are underground caverns there. There's no doubt. I mean, I even talked to a friend of a girl that I knew years ago out of St. Louis. Her sister worked at the airport and would see people go in there and not come out. So I know they were building things in there, but that's a good question. Where do you take the dirt and the rocks and all that stuff?
Yeah, you would think if they're digging under the United States that there'd be big piles of tailings around, and I never hear of it, never see it. If they melt the rock, you know, it doesn't mean it shrinks down. It's still got to be the same size. I don't know how they dig those tunnels, but what happens to it?
Poof, it's gone. Good question.
Maybe you can ask one of the guys on your tunnel program to answer that question.
Because we've never gotten the witnesses about that. Because we never get witnesses about the building of the tunnels at all anyway. It's after the fact. Let's go to Blue Moon, Kentucky. Danette, welcome to Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Oh, hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Oh,
my pleasure. What's new?
What's new is a lot of stuff I've been reading on Benjamin Fulford's website, kind of adding to what a previous caller said. Are you familiar with a lot of the things he's been talking about?
No, not a lot. Brief me.
Okay, well, basically he's been talking about how over the last year or so, how Oriental societies and governments are getting together to correct and prosecute what they call the satanic cabal that's responsible for the Federal Reserve and the whole collapse of the...
They're going to go after them all. You think that really will happen?
He's claiming that Tim Geithner was arrested maybe a month ago, and that he talked so much that the quote from the police, they said usually they have to slap someone around to get them to talk. They said that they had to slap them around to get them to shut up. They said Geithner ratted out Bill Gates and Poppy Bush as being complicit in trying to, you know, collapse the world financial system, or, you know, whatever their involvement is, that they've all been arrested in the last month. He's also said that the noises that probably connected to the noises that we're hearing, he says that earthquake what was purported to be the earthquake outside of D.C. was actually a nuclear bomb that was put in the underground bunkers. And he says the nuclear bombs, the ones in Colorado, were blown up, and other ones were blown up so that this elite power group has no place to run.
Well, here's some of the things you got to be careful of, Danette, because a lot of times where there's, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. There's no doubt about that. And we can't just believe everything that we're told by government. But some of the stories get a little far-fetched. I don't believe that Timothy Geithner was arrested or talked like a bird and whistle blew on everything. As a matter of fact, just today, I think he was talking about China and San Francisco. So, you know, he's okay. There's nothing going on there with him. And, you know, so all these other rumors, you have to be very careful about. And that's where the credibility of so many people, you know, is at stake. You have to be very careful what you say. You want to have facts. Well, it's one of the things I like about Alex Jones. Alex reports on things that are bona fide news stories, and he's smart enough to interpret them once he gets them. But when people just say things like, you know, Treasury Secretary Geithner was arrested and slapped around, you know, sure, you know, it's great copy, and it sounds strange, and it sounds, well, is this possible? But, I mean, he's out doing his thing. You know, he's still the Treasury Secretary. He was speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco today about exporting to China and selling things. So I've got to say no to that. You know, so some people, when they set up these websites and they go ahead and say all these things, you got to be very, very careful what you read. Let's go to Philadelphia. Kim, welcome to the program. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, good morning. I think you're making your dad proud every day that you come on the air.
Well, thank you.
Well, yeah, I always think about him and you and the connection there. But I have a comment to make. Early on your show, you brought up the breatharian thing.
Yes.
And I used to be fascinated with breatharianism to a point while living in Atlanta. But I wanted to report that most recently, Mr. Ajani was brought, like, maybe 7 or 8 years ago to Philadelphia by the integrative, Thomas Jefferson's Integrative Medicine Department to try to debunk whether or not he really was, you know, just using water only.
Okay.
We had an opportunity to actually meet with him and to speak with him personally. And he was quite unique, but one thing that was unique about him is that he lived in the Himalayas. And he was saying it's completely impossible in our chaos to coexist in a way that he's able to coexist.
So did you believe him?
Well, to be in his presence, his aura is so unique. He didn't wear any shoes, and they watched him for 14 days and under camera surveillance. And I think that report can be retrieved through Thomas Jefferson's Integrative. The doctor who brought him in was Dr. George Brainerd. Dr. Brainerd brought him into Philadelphia under a research study. So I'll be honest with you, I do, because I looked into his eyes. His pupils were so unique compared to the average human being.
Well, you know, when I saw that story, Kim, you know, some time ago, you know, I said it was very possible that there are people out there, human beings, that can adapt like that. Not everybody can. Obviously, the woman in Switzerland could not. But I think it's possible.
I went 40 days personally under uncontrolled circumstances. I went 40 days.
With nothing? With nothing?
With water only.
Water only. Okay. How much weight did you lose?
And he does drink water. He did say he drinks water. That's the only thing he does do is drink water, Mr. Ajani.
He just takes like a few sips, right?
I don't know how much, but he was drinking water here. Under these conditions, he was completely strained. I don't think he was very happy in our climate or time zone.
Probably not. How much weight did you lose on the 40-day fast?
I lost about 45, 46 pounds.
Now, did you get to a point, though, where you were beginning to become unhealthy?
No, actually, the only reason why I left is I started getting kind of intimidated by people who were observing. So, you know, I felt very good, actually. After the third day, I was sailing. And the 40th day, I could have went the 41st or the 42nd day, but I wasn't sure about the metabolism and how, you know, how, and I was much younger too. Mind you, this happened like maybe 26 years ago, my experience of breatharianism in Atlanta, which is a higher altitude than Philadelphia.
What got you to go back to start eating again and drinking a lot?
Well, I'm a vegan, and, you know, I just take it light. I do fast a lot. I fast, like, usually 4 days. I eat 3 days, and I fast four because I don't have a very physical lifestyle.
Right.
I wanted to ask you, some years ago, you interviewed Dr. Delbert Blair. Do you remember this guy out of Chicago?
Yes.
Do you have any plans to bring him back? Because I'm very interested in some of the work.
You know, I'll check with Tom and Lisa, and we'll check back into him.
Yeah, well, that would be great because I think he's quite interesting, and I hadn't heard him over your program in the last couple of years, maybe 4 or 5 years, maybe more than that.
Okay, we'll definitely check back. Thanks, Kim. Let's go to Brock in Manhattan, east of the Rockies. Hey, Brock, good morning.
Hey, George. Great to be on your show.
Thank you.
You're awesome. I want to talk to you about a little bit about the alien, whole alien thing.
Okay.
Everybody's been, you know, trying to look up in the sky and see if they can see a UFO, and people are really interested in that. It seems like it's part of our genetics to look up there all the time and expect to see something. But my point that I'm trying to make is basically, I don't think alien extraterrestrials and UFOs are really, you know, plausible, because basically, why would they have to come here and be seen in our consciousness the way our consciousness is when we wake up? And what leads me to say that is basically dimethyltryptamine. I know that you know about that.
Yeah.
And you know, I know that you had some people on the show talking about it. Maybe the creator, the creators, or maybe they're extraterrestrials that created the Earth in the first place. Maybe they put, you know, maybe the Earth is like a, you know, it's like our consciousness is kind of like a video game, and it's a quest. And the quest part of the Garden of Eden, and within the Garden of Eden, there's certain substances that are electrochemical substances that act on the brain that have been lost, you know, that are still, you know, pretty much not part of our culture anymore. But maybe there is certain codes within these molecules, within the plants, within our brains, that were to take us to the aliens, not have them come to, you know, come down and visit us, but actually have us, you know, contact them by altering our consciousness.
Well, if you believe in the concept of remote viewing, we probably have gone to all kinds of places. And are we genetically inclined to communicate with them that way? Maybe. Maybe. I still think we've been visited. I think we're continued to be visited. But I think they came here a long, long time ago. Susie in Los Angeles, just a few moments here, Susie. Let's get you in here.
Hi, George. Love you. Love your show. Thank you for everything you do. Real quick, I recently read an online ebook called Allies of Humanity as channeled by Marshall Vian Summers, and it kind of changed my perspective on the alien interaction that's happening right now. I do believe it's happening. I believe myself I might have even had contact. I cannot say for sure. I don't think government disclosure is going to happen quite yet, if ever, because I think our government has sold us out to the alien presence. My theory is that our government has been manipulated by the alien presence in exchange for vital Earth resources, Earth minerals, etc.,
mm-hmm.
and that the reason disclosure will not happen is because they have sold us out and they don't want the general public to know. So, I mean, the truth is out there. The truth is up in the sky. It's in our minds. It's in our hearts. And I'm not sure that alien contact is necessarily a good thing. It's mystifying. It's amazing. A lot of us think it's spiritual, but there is a really dark side to it as well.
Oh, there sure is. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to take this quick break and come right back with investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe, who's with us. The last hour of the program tonight, stories of high strangeness with Linda, and, of course, conversations with Linda. Right here on Coast to Coast AM.